welcome to episode 410 of Retro Encounter, RPG Fans Weekly Podcast of Many Topics. I'm Mike Solosi, and I have to live in the past a little bit because we are playing Final Fantasy IV for this podcast. But when I started playing it late last month, I liked it so much and I was having such a good time. I finished it in like 4 or 5 days because FF4 went down about as smoothly as an RPG of this ilk could for me. So this is going to be a nostalgia, rose-tinted glasses episode from me. Maybe you're used to that by now. But let's see how it is for the rest of the panel, starting with Alex Ranichek.
Hello. My glasses are still quite fogged up, but that fog is cleared. I've been seeing this game through a whole new lens with the DS version, which just ended up being a really fresh take on the game. Completely like revitalized the way I've played it. The augment system was crazy and fun and weird, and I just had a really good time dying and trying to re-strategize and rethinking my approaches to these different boss fights. And I got a lot of thoughts on this version of the game, and looking forward to chatting.
Of course, you found a way to turn Final Fantasy IV into a Souls-like. Makes sense.
And they even got a new game plus feature with this version that lets you play it 2 more times with damage scaling and new super bosses, which I might end up going back to at some point.
That's excellent.
That's interesting. But also, you just heard there, Zach Wilkerson.
Hello, and I don't like random encounters, so I didn't really have them in this version. Very different experience.
we talked a little bit before recording, and I wish I knew as much as you did going into the Pixel Remaster version. But joining Zach, Alex, and I is Lucas Green, who is one person, I promise.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Have I been
lied
to? There's
three. Apparently there's multiples of me, so.
Oh, no, you cast image. Great.
I did, often.
Really?
Especially fighting behemoths.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. I mean, I maybe I was just sticking to my like elementary school age lizard brain. I'm not sure I had Edge do anything besides attack or use items with his high speed this entire game. I did not explore the depths of his kit, at least not to the degree I did Rosa or Rydia. But just going right in. We will run through the second half of the story in this episode, but mostly I care more about feelings than facts for Final Fantasy IV. Like, as we mentioned in the previous episode, all four of us played this when we were much younger in the 1990s. And for all of us, this is, you know, multiple playthroughs over the decades. And but we're all playing a recent-ish version, or a very recent version for Zach, Lucas, and I, and a less recent version for Alex. What are our feelings? How did Final Fantasy IV hold up for y'all?
I think that when you say like it goes down smooth, I think that's the way that I feel about Final Fantasy IV. Like, you played it in 4 or 5 days. I played it in like 2. That's not a brag. It's like it's just once I start on it, I just roll through it really quickly. And it's almost impossible for me to divorce my feelings about the game from a nostalgia perspective from my play of the game. So like, it's hard for me to say like, does it hold up? Does it not hold up? What I can say is for me, I still have a blast when I play it. I see all the seams and the cracks and the jank of it and the weirdness of it. And I don't care because it's Final Fantasy IV and it's a great game. And I really enjoy my time with it every time through any version, except for the DS version, Alex.
And you know, I did enjoy the DS version when I played it many, many years ago, at least 15 years ago. I don't even know if I recorded it from my fledgling blog at the time. But maybe it's because I've played this game so many times and I know all of the story beats and basically know I didn't have to do much puzzle solving or like struggle in a meaningful way. But this just felt cozy and nostalgic to me, even though like there is a challenge at times, especially if you know don't know the answer already, like I for the most part do. But Lucas, you we were even talking about how you have been playing Final Fantasy IV randomizers and fan hacks over the years. How did a more let's say a less adjusted version of the game treat you this time around?
I actually ran into a lot of weird problems because I'm so familiar with the SNES version. Just the things that were fixed in the Pixel remaster, like the little bugs and adjustments, things like the fact that haste and slow are status effects instead of the way they actually, or they work in the original, and just little dumb things that 90% of people probably don't know. I actually struggled a couple times, but I will say I did really still like the Pixel remaster. The playthrough was still, like you said, cozy, breezy. I think kind of the conclusion I came to was, I'm not sure if I would go back to the Pixel remaster, but if somebody was less familiar with it, it's definitely great version for somebody who's not familiar with it to pick up and play. It felt good.
Yeah, and I guess it's similar for me. Like, I still think that maybe my favorite version of this game is the PSP version, because it does have some extra content that's not always great, but is at least mostly fun, and lets me, you know, like, you know, use souped up versions of Palom Porum and Yang. I mean, the Pixel remaster version is remarkably faithful and let me do some very fun things, like turn off random encounters. You know, I think my I clocked in right around 10 hours for this game, but it could have been probably 8 at least, because I knew about turning random encounters off and on, but I didn't know that you could go into the menu and like have 4 times experience points turned on. So I was doing a normal level of grinding occasionally, but I could have cut that probably, I mean, definitely by a quarter, maybe by even more.
I think I did, for the beginning of the game, I literally, when I got a new character, I did one fight with them at 4 times experience, like one random encounter. And then I'd turn encounters back off. And then most of the game, I was just doing a boss rush with like a couple exceptions where I picked up some sirens and went to the spots where I know you can get some good XP.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't quite that smart about it, but I definitely, you know, we'll talk about it. But Zeromus, I think, is still a challenge in this version. And I walked around the area right before Zeromus and definitely had that 4 times XP thing on. And where is it? Took you 2 hours. It took me about 20 minutes to get from 44 to about 50.
Yeah, we'll talk about this later, but at the final dungeon, I was woefully underleveled. So I just I did maybe 2 hours or so of grinding, just walking back and forth. It was not very smart grinding, because I should have turned the experience meter way to the max and maybe used a siren or something. But I was like, whatever. I threw on a podcast and somehow got a rare item drop during all of that nonsense. So some regrets about how I handled it at times, but no regrets about playing this game for the first time. And Alex, you went into this a little bit already in the introduction, but this is your first time playing the DS version of Final Fantasy IV.
Mm-hmm.
And you mostly liked the changes that it did for gameplay wrinkles. But I mean, if my memory serves from last week, you didn't like some of the visual choices or audio choices as much. Like, but you are considering a replay of this game for via New Game Plus. So like, do you think Final Fantasy IV DS is like worth it? Is it an ideal version to play if you maybe played a couple of the other versions? Like what are your feelings on this version relative to all the others that you've played? Because I think none of us have played, say, the WonderSwan Color version of FF4, but all of us have played multiple versions of this game.
Yeah, so honestly, I went into the DS version expecting it to probably be my least favorite version. I just like, just looking at the screenshots and whatnot and hearing some of the voice acting in the past, like, I'm just like, this is not gonna offer like that prime nostalgic FF4 experience that y'all were talking about. So I just thought it wasn't gonna hit the same notes for me and wasn't gonna resonate quite as much as a result. And to an extent that was true. Is I was definitely a little slow getting into it. I was just playing it for like an hour or so at a time. Just easing into like the gameplay, easing into like the new difficulty and whatnot. And then like kind of around the halfway point when I started picking up more augments and stuff and customizing my party builds and just seeing like the different synergies with abilities that you can put on your different party members, like the game just completely opened up to me in a way that like now I'm not sure if like I could even go back to any other version of this game and get the same joy out of it in terms of like the gameplay. I mean, I'm still interested in the Pixel Remaster version, especially just the idea of breezing through the game in like 10 or less hours, avoiding random encounters. Sounds like an honestly pleasant experience, especially with that new orchestrated music. But
so good.
Yeah, but
it's real good.
I mean, like, yeah, I'm going to get around to that at some point. But like, I am fiending for more of this augment system. And yeah, the DS version has like, yeah, the new game plus. You can do up to 2 extra playthroughs of the game where all your augments and some of your stat increases carry over. So you can really get into some like min-maxing and like hyper-strategizing nonsense that, I mean, if that's your kind of thing, if like you're an FF5 sicko, like you can have like a really, really good time with this game also. And that's just like a level of challenge, of customizability and like satisfaction from the battles that I just wasn't expecting. And that honestly blew me away.
And on this replay, or a hypothetical replay, you can take the proper steps to get dual cast this time around.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, it won't be a problem now since I've got like,
you won't have to make as many augment choices because you'll already have some good ones.
Exactly, and leftover still that I didn't end up using during my first playthrough, that'll carry over as well. So, I mean, even without dual cast, I was able to like stumble on some really, really crazy stuff that I'll get into maybe when we talk about the end of the game.
Awesome. And well, I guess we should talk about the end of the game, or more accurately, the middle of the game where we left off last time. Where we stopped, we had finished the Tower of Zot sequence. So our party is Cecil, Kane, Rosa, Sid, and Yang. And we get a magma key that's on Kane's person at the end of that event. And they don't give you a ton of direction, but if you go to a few of the towns that you haven't explored yet, one of them is a town where the residents claim to have descended from dwarves, and there's a well that goes allegedly to the center of the earth. In the middle of the town. And if you throw that magma key from Kane down that well, the mountain behind it opens way the hell up, and you can use your airship to dive in and explore an underworld segment where you, happen to find a kingdom of dwarves directly below the village of dwarf descendants on the overworld. And so this is, you know, it's a classic Final Fantasy trope, at least back to FF3, maybe earlier, that there's actually a second world or a second world state that you have to visit or experience. But yeah, in this area, Sid leaves your party pretty early because the heat is bad for the airship and he needs to check it out. But you talk to the King of Dwarves and he's like, oh yeah, Golbez is down here and he's trying to get our crystals because he needs the 4 crystals of the light world and the 4 crystals of the underworld to achieve his ends. And he already has 2 of them, but luckily he can't get the one that's behind my throne. And then suddenly you hear some noises behind his throne.
You go to you.
Yeah. Like the timing is really remarkable. I should say this, the boss fight that happens very soon after this is one of my least favorite in the game, not for any mechanical reason, but because I genuinely am creeped out let's say like horror movie dolls or horror movie children, if that makes sense. My fears are weird. I'm not afraid of clowns, but I am afraid of dolls. Does that make sense?
No.
Well, it's the truth. I am creeped out by dolls sometimes, and the boss fight against creepy dolls with a minor key waltz playing, I did not enjoy that as a child. So yeah, you fight 6 dolls called Calbrainas they're called Cal and Braina, and it's pretty normal, but after a certain period they combine into a giant Calbraina doll, which is a physical powerhouse. I think its counterattacks can like one-shot Rosa if you're very unlucky, or maybe also one-shot a front row character. You know, it's a medium challenge boss fight for the, you know, relative to the rest of this game. But after you defeat Calbraina, Golbez pops in. He takes the crystal, but not until he almost kills your party by summoning a shadow dragon and eliminating you one by one, until suddenly a new warrior enters the ring, and of all people, Rydia comes to rescue you. And Rydia takes out the shadow dragon very quickly. Golbez flees, but he does take the crystal with him, because his quote
it's question embodied mark, hand.
Yeah, his severed arm or disembodied hand grabs the crystal and runs. That always, I don't know, that always seemed odd to me. But Rydia rejoins your party, but now instead of being a elementary school age girl, she's a teenager. Because when the shipwreck happened in the first half of the game, the king of summoned monsters, Leviathan, took her down to the kingdom of summoned monsters, which is in the underworld. And in the underworld, time flows much more quickly there. So over a period of, say, several days, she was training and living with the monsters in the underworld for, at her perspective, something like 10 years. So she was aware when you arrived into the underworld and came to meet you and stumbled upon all this Golbez stuff. So with they gloss over this sort of quickly, but she but this is like, oh, Rydia is 18 instead of 8 now, or I don't know what the actual number is, but something like that. Welcome to the team, and now she's your powerful summoner black mage again. So like, I mean, I really like Rydia in Final Fantasy IV. She was, I don't know, maybe my favorite character growing up, just because I just liked powerful mage characters in games like these. But yeah, it's a kind of a wild plot point for it to happen very, very quickly, and she's with you for the rest of the game from this point on.
I feel like they kind of glossed over it is maybe a term you could use for a lot of this game.
I was going to say, that's pretty much this whole half of the game.
Yeah. I agree with that, but it's still like it's a really cool moment. Like it's one that I always look forward to. Like, I think the underworld in general to me, like, feels like a little bit of a drag sometimes. Like, it's my least favorite part of the game, but like that moment. And I remember, like, when I was a kid really struggling with that boss fight, like just kind of like almost having to like phase it out. Like I would die to the giant doll and then I would die to Golbez or whatever. And I remember it being a challenge, which I liked, but Rydia showing up is just like it feels iconic in a way that it shouldn't, because it doesn't really make they make all kinds of excuses for why it happens, but it's still so cool.
I mean, I love this moment because if anything, she's like, I'm not a little kid anymore. Now I can fight to save the world for real now. And she's just cool and confident and knows a ton of black magic. And yeah, I love everything about that. She loses the ability to cast white magic, which I don't know exactly why they made that choice. I mean, they made that choice because she's your offensive mage and Rydia is your healer and defensive mage. But she's like, well, I grew up, so I can't use white magic anymore. But it's like, all right, that's fine. But why? Question mark.
She's so squishy anyway. It's not like she's overpowered or something. So. I agree.
Yeah, she has the lowest HP of your team by far. In endgame boss fights, she's usually the first one to faint, unless you know, Edge gets real overconfident. But I mean, she is your random battle screen clearer a lot of the time. So yeah. I mean, she's still awesome. But yeah, you're a bit of a glass cannon mage. But I'm still glad to see her around. But anyway, after this happens, the dwarves. Like, they acknowledge that they're in a crisis, but they accept your help and accept your presence. Yeah, so they treat your arrival and everything that's happening with, at least to me, surprising nonchalance. But maybe just plot points happen fast in RPGs like this. Like, when we played Suikoden 1 for the podcast, I want to say 2 years ago, everything happened so fast, I felt like I had whiplash, but that was because I was used to playing, you know, 2020s RPGs around the same time. So you continue on. You don't have an airship, but you can walk to the to where Golbez forces are based in the Tower of Babel, while you have cover fire from dwarven tanks fighting the Baron, fighting Golbez's Red Wings. And then you have another futuristic tower dungeon. To my memory, the Tower of Babel really looks the same as the Tower of Zot. And because the Tower of Zot's not really on the map, I think at least for several years, I thought the Tower of Babel and the Tower of Zot were the same place. The Tower of Zot is above ground and Tower of Babel is underground.
I get that mixed up all the time, so I understand.
Yeah.
I think that's why for the DS version, they changed the look of the Tower of Zot, just so you can, like, you can be sure it's a different place that just doesn't exist on the map for some reason. But yeah, for the Tower of Babel, at least they stuck with the futuristic techno look.
Yeah, it's I mean, for some reason, the Machine Tower tile set is just not my favorite in Final Fantasy IV.
No.
But they use it again at least three times. Well, yeah, I think exactly three times. But anyway, there's another one of those. And at the top of the tower, you fight a creepy scientist named Dr. Lugai, or Lugay maybe, and also his sort of Frankenstein's monster helper. And after that boss fight, while you're escaping the tower, like they're planning on detonating a bomb that'll wipe out all the dwarves that helped you enter the tower. But in a moment of noble sacrifice, Yang locks himself in the control room or something of the tower and is able to shut it down in time, or at least I think he is. But and while you're leaping off the tower, Cid rescues you in the airship and takes you back to the surface again. But while you're being chased by the Red Wings, Cid detonates a bomb at the top of the tower, leading him to fall possibly to his death. But it leaves you on the surface world with the path to the underworld sealed behind you. So you went from, like, you know, feeling pretty good about maybe taking down Golbez to losing Cid and Yang for the rest of the game and under sad/scary circumstances, perhaps. So we all know this already, and listeners, that you know that we're spoiling everything about this game. Cid and Yang end up okay, but like how did it feel seeing these back to back noble sacrifices?
These two are the ones that always get the most crap from when I hear discussions about this game, and I feel like this translation of it, or this version of it, they actually addressed Yang's sacrifice a little bit better, because I don't remember in the original them talking about, you know, why he had to do what he did. And in this one, it was very clear. It was like he went in because the cannons were targeting the dwarves, the imps broke the controls, and Yang was like, I'm going to go take out the cannons themselves by sacrificing myself. Cid, on the other hand, like, if you have a bomb and there's airships following you, what's the difference between you jumping off with a bomb and you dropping a bomb?
Maybe you have slightly more control over where it goes.
A little bit, but
no, I
know.
You're right. I mean, like, I think that if there's a criticism that is commonly leveled against 4, it is that they, and this is true of a lot of Japanese media in general, I think, they don't know how to make a death stick, and this game has no idea how to make a death stick except for one. They did it one time. But I, you know, it's funny because, like, when I play it, it still feels dramatic to me. It still feels like it means something. And I think about it, I was just like kind of listening to Stelosi describe it, and I'm like, oh man, that sounds so stupid. And then I'm like, wait a second, I love that moment. It's so good. But I think it gets back to what we were talking about earlier. Like, I just can't separate my 8-year-old, 7-year-old feelings from my, in this case, 38-year-old feelings. So yeah, it's interesting the way that it established all these tropes and that it does them so kind of poorly in a lot of ways, but it doesn't bother me because I don't know. Like, I still remember Cid jumping off and like being like emotional about it when I first played the game.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, Yang's death when I was a kid, like that felt devastating. He was probably my favorite character at the time. I thought he was so cool.
I was so happy to have Yang back. I'm sorry, to have Rydia back, because Rydia and Yang really were my two favorites. And I'm like, oh, This is just like the Fabul Castle part of the game, except we have Kane instead of Edward, which is a straight upgrade. So this is like my favorite party of the game for the most part, the Tower of Babel party. And I was my new working theory is that they just wanted to get rid of all the 30 and 40 something men in the party, so you could have a party of only teenagers and 20 somethings. So Cid and Yang had to go.
Yeah, that's a fair theory. But I mean, seeing these deaths in like the kind of janky, not the best 3D graphics. Like I remember like feeling emotional about these deaths as a kid. remember replaying the game like 10 years ago and still thinking they were like cool moments. This time I just like had my eyebrows raised. I'm like, this is ridiculous. But, and I was also thinking, like, I wonder, like, why there aren't more RPGs that have like this kind of like party switching in terms of like having like specific sets of parties like throughout the game that are always switching due to like circumstances in the plot. And then I realized, like, oh, maybe it's because other RPGs afterwards didn't want to come up with these shoehorned reasons and sacrifices in order to make these switches make sense.
I mean, the other side of that is the actual reason is because they could, because they introduced more mechanics and they figured out how to allow you to switch party members and keep more than five at a time. Whereas this one kind of established what a lot of this was. I mean, there's not a lot of games that have named characters even before this in terms of RPGs.
Well, I mean, even in Final Fantasy II for the NES, there's characters that come and go in your party. But right. But Final Fantasy IV is not a game with a ton of customization or a class system like FF3 or even FF1. So I think they wanted to give you different party members and have your ability set and toolkit change over the course of the game.
Oh, for sure. And yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to say, is like that just allows for like very considered like enemy and boss encounters, because it's all built around like the specific kits you'll have at that point in the game, which I think is still like one of this game's like strongest points from a gameplay perspective.
You compare it to something like Final Fantasy III that requires very specific kits.
For some boss fights, especially, yeah.
Yeah, like you have to mini like for like 30% of that game, it feels like. Whereas here, they sort of seem to fix that in their own way. And so you can still see them learning, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's one of the most interesting parts of playing these early games is watching them learn from their mistakes. And they tried to take a big swing with Final Fantasy III, and it was, you know, they connected in some ways and missed in other ways. But I feel like this is their first like real connection. And I agree with what Lucas is saying as well. Like they have a lot more flexibility with something like Final Fantasy VI or V,
or every game after IV.
Sure. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. But I think it's really cool just to see them sort of learning from the experimentation they've done previously.
I think Alex's point about allowing them to really hone in on how the boss fights work and how they balance everything, knowing what toolkits you have available, is a really good point. And maybe, I mean, why Yang had to leave the party, because Yang gets really overpowered when he's higher level, might be it. And you don't need to give him equipment.
I think it's easier than that. I mean, I think they just wanted to give you edge. Like they're like, right. Oh, we want them to have edge at this part of the game. Like they curate basically what your party and what your toolkit is throughout the game. But to explain that, they need to have departures and arrivals from within your party, which is fine. It seems a little dated because, I mean, all four of us are used to RPGs where you can choose your party once the number gets above the party limit size. But, I mean, they have to come up with reasons for those arrivals and departures, and a lot of them happen to be, like, random deaths or noble sacrifices. And it seems a little ridiculous after a point. It's like, oh, well, Rydia's been attacked, and Yang left trying to save her. And it's like, oh, well, Tella has his famous noble sacrifice. Now Palm and Porom have a noble sacrifice. Well, actually, Tella was after them, but never mind. But there's just an unusual amount of noble sacrificing happening in this game.
Yes,
sometimes as just a reason for your party to change its makeup, which it does make for pretty good melodrama, because a character death or a scene like that is powerful for the most part when handled gracefully, but it does seem a little bit strange after it happens for the fifth or sixth time in Final Fantasy IV, and those departures are not always very graceful, and I'm mostly side-eyeing. Like the Cid slowly falling off the airship with the, like, sound effect.
Yeah, Sid's is definitely the worst, just because it's like back to back with Yang's. Like, it, like 10 minutes of two sacrifices in like 5 or 10 minutes is just a bit absurd.
So I mentioned Edge a little while ago, and he's the next party member to join you. And for a while, you actually have the final party as your main party for a lengthy section of the game. So you're on the surface again. I remember being stuck at this point because I it just did not occur to me to go to Baron and tell Cid's workshop people to modify the airship. I don't have a great reason for this. I just was a dumb kid that sometimes struggled with a very non-linear part of an RPG. There's far more embarrassing stories than this one on how why I abandoned certain games because of I couldn't figure out where to go next. You know, pre GameFAQs days. But anyway, if you visit Sid's engineers, they add a hook to the airship so you can go find Edward's old hovercraft and carry it around the map, so it's not on the same, it's not on the Damsian continent anymore. And basically, this gives you an opportunity to explore the shallows areas of other continents, which I think isn't a ton of places. It's the Mithril Mine Cave.
Yep.
And also the Eblon continent, where the Tower of Babel is. Transporting yourself back to the 90s, you probably explored Eblon Castle, wasn't really sure what was going on. When you finally get the hovercraft over there, you find a cave that you realize is, oh, this is another means to get to the Tower of Babel and continue the story. In there, the Castle Eblon nearby is abandoned. And you learn pretty soon that it was attacked by Golbez's forces and the king and queen were kidnapped. So the prince, Edge, or Ed, I think his name's like Edgar Geraldine or something, but he goes by Edge. And then Prince Edge, the ninja, joins your team. You find the remnants of the people of Eblon living underground. And eventually you find your way back to a new section of the Tower of Babel, where in a pretty heartbreaking scene, but that also happens a little bit too fast, because I think you meet Edge like 10 minutes before this happens. you fight the mutated king and queen of Eblon. It's a pretty much a scripted fight. There's they don't deal a lot of damage to you, and you can't kill them by normal means. But so Edge is having a mental breakdown fighting them, but they eventually come to their senses and kill themselves and tell Edge to be a good king, which is, again, a heartbreaking moment, but it gives you a little bit of tonal whiplash, because this is, especially if you had encounters turned off like me, this is just like right after you meet Edge. You see his parents die before his eyes. A little strange.
When I was playing through this time, one of the observations I had was exactly that. And I was thinking it would have been a lot easier to give that direction that you were talking about, you know, like you don't know where to go, and also introduce some of those like characters a little bit more. If they had moments earlier in the game where they referenced them, I don't think Eblon is even mentioned early game at all. And it would be really easy to just mention, like have the King of Baron mention Eblon, or have the king and queen show up like as Cecil's getting kicked out of the castle or something like that, you know, where there's like a little, like just give you a chance to have a little bit of crossover there, just to know that it exists and meet those characters beforehand.
That's the case earlier in the game too, though, because I don't think you hear about Damsian or Fabul or Troia until just before you're supposed to go there.
Right.
The game is very sort of narrow-minded in where you are right now and where you're supposed to go next. And there's little in the way of like foreshadowing or world building as you're playing the game. It's only as you experience the events that you're supposed to be in at that time.
I was just thinking as we were having this conversation, why was Eplin, you know, kingdom chilling there under this giant technological tower? Like, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of great resources or you know, economic strategy to being over there. Not the best world building.
No, don't think about it too hard. Most that they do is like, I think at one point in the game they like mention the name of a couple of places where like crystals were stolen from. And that's like pretty much the extent of references to like other places in the world that you get. But it's an interesting point that you made about like the tonal whiplash of like recruiting Edge and then getting to see his parents in the dramatic moment with them, because it made me think like I didn't experience that as much, but I can definitely see that being the case with random encounters turned off. And I guess it just made me think about like how an old school RPG like this, like it kind of depended on the fact of you taking time to like do battles and just like spend more time with the game, with the party in general, even though there's not like much narrative development, in order to kind of like feel more connected with the characters. Like you just connect with the characters through battling with them. And that's kind of like how a lot of the, how you even like grow to like the characters and think about them in the first place. And with a game like this, where like you're switching party members so often, I could see that being actually really disorienting, just like kind of going from like plot point to plot point, which are, as we discussed earlier, just so sudden and truncated, to like not like make much sense and to have like the same kinds of impact. I just thought that was an interesting point.
I will say, all of that said, the fight against Edge's parents is really awesome moment, and the way they do it, where you actually end up in the battle with them and you have the dialogue while you're dealing with it, and like it's another one of those really good examples of how they use the game mechanics to do that very cinematic moment.
And I was gonna say, like, I can't think of a ton of games before this that had a scripted fight in this way, and it feels really impactful. Like, as you were saying, Solicit, they don't do much damage, and so, you know, when we think about like games that use mechanics to communicate story, and I don't think that this game does it often or necessarily well in all the cases, but here I feel like you see something that gets picked up by a lot of games going forward, the idea of a scripted fight that has emotional impact.
I do have an ultimate example of that, and it's a scene in the first, let's say, the first third of Dragon Quest V. But Final Fantasy IV predates Dragon Quest V by a year or two, so this was a very effective use of that. I think it's especially for being so early.
No, I agree.
And this game had, you know, the fight against with Cecil against himself, and you've got
also Tella against Golbez, and he uses Meteor. That's another really great one.
That's right. Yeah.
Edward has the like fight where Anna's ghost is talking to him.
There's the entire prologue to the final battle is entirely in Combat Engine.
Yeah, that one's great too. The good version
of it. That one felt a little bit too long for me, but that was also one I had to do four times.
Yeah, you do it many times in a row. It's pretty frustrating.
Even you have to see it again when you have to see it again after every attempt. Around attempt by attempt three or four, it's starting to feel less emotional.
I'm sorry. We'll get to the whole Golbez reveal, but that part has never set well with me.
Well, moving on in the story a little bit, after this, you fight, I don't know if he's my favorite villain, but I think one of the more memorable mid-bosses of the game, Rubikante, the leader of the four elemental fiends. He just loves fighting and a challenge, and is the only chivalrous one of the four fiends. He mentions that he's the one that tells you, oh no, Dr. Lugai turned them into monsters, but then I kicked Edge's ass, and you're here for seconds, aren't you? And the two times you fight Rubikante, he heals you before your boss fight against him, which I wish bosses would do more often, frankly. But they're just they're just communicating how honorable he is, especially compared to all the other villains in this game.
I love that detail. Yeah,
but Rubikante is a pretty cool boss fight. You have to like time your attacks for when his cloak is open; otherwise, every move will heal him. His spells get more powerful as his health gets low, so you can't you have to sort of really squeeze your last couple of hits in before he can overwhelm you with Fire 3 or what have you, or Furaga. But yeah, so that's a pretty tough fight. And then after that, I think there's not much else to do here except you find a new airship to take you underground. Or am I forgetting a scene here?
Well, I mean, you walk past him and into the crystal chamber, and there's a trap door for some reason.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. That also felt random to me, but I think that maybe just Golbez isn't around because he's looking for the last dark crystal.
Yeah.
And but now that you have a new airship, you can get and you're back in the underworld. You can get around a little better. And if you take the airship, but the airship is it can't cross the magma ocean of the underworld. So you have to go back to the Dwarf Kingdom, where you find Cid recovering from his injuries, and he can wrap the ship in mithril, so you can travel anywhere in the underworld now, giving you a little bit of freedom for this part of the game. The King of the Dwarves gives you the key to the sealed cave where the last crystal is, but and you can go straight there if you want, or you can explore around a little bit. There's some towns with better equipment, and there's two optional dungeons, one that goes to the Sylph Cave, where you find some summoned monsters called Sylphs taking care of Yang. So Yang also survived his fall, but he's much more badly injured than Cid is. If you talk, you can see Yang, but nothing really happens yet. Later in the game, if you go to Yang's wife, she'll give you I don't remember if the items change between the different versions of the game, but she gives you a frying pan. She gives you a frying pan. Then if you go back and do the Sylph Cave again, which really stinks in older versions of the game when you can't turn off random encounters, hit Yang with the frying pan to wake him up. Then after that happens, the Sylphs join you as a summoned monster, which is pretty good because wind damage or I think it's non-elemental for here is a little uncommon until you get to end game stuff. And also Sylph heals you. So that's a nice little trick. But and then after Sylph has joined you, if you go back to Yang's wife, she gives you the kitchen knife, which is sort of the ultimate throne item for Edge. It's a guaranteed 9,999 to one target. But we're not quite there yet. There's also the cave towards the land of the summoned monsters, which the Sylph Cave and that cave have similar tile sets, and there's a lot of damage floors and a lot of hidden or invisible passages. This is not my favorite part of the game because I think both of those dungeons are kind of a drag.
So obnoxious. And look, the fact that you have to recast float every floor.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a bummer.
Or if you're like me, you can forget that and just have the entire dungeon at 1 HP the entire time because you turned off random encounters.
Fun fact, the first time I went into Sylph Cave, I was like running around a bit and I was like taking the damage from like the poison or whatever. And I'm just like, wait, doesn't the game like give you something at some point that lets you like not take damage? I'm like, oh, god damn it, it's just float. but that was a funny moment of forgetting everything about the game.
Well, it's not like it tells you.
Yeah, you were thinking that, oh, this is FF5 where geomancers will prevent all of
this. Yeah. I'm like, do I get like a key item? It's like floating boots or something? And I'm like, oh my god. But so is the just because my memory's a bit blurry, the cave that takes you to the Fae March, the land of the Eidolons, is it not like fire themed in this game? You said it had a similar tile set. It's different in the DS one.
I mean, it looks pretty similar. Like one's like looks the same and it's green, that's the Sylph Cave, yeah. And this one looks the same and it's red and it's the Eidolon cave essentially.
It's a different color palette, but the same the same tile set.
Right. I think they made it a little more distinct in the DS, but yeah, basically same idea.
But they both have damage floors and they both take you to summons because at the Fae March, it's a slightly maze-like town where with friendly monsters as its denizens, they all love Rydia there because she had spent the past 10 years there. And even if you're there for hours, it'll probably just take place as seconds in the underworld because of how time flows differently. And if you want, you can challenge the king and queen of the Fae March, Asura and Leviathan, to battle, and they'll join you as summons if you're able to defeat them. They're maybe a little challenging if you go there right when you're first able to. I was underleveled, so I just like, I'll do this later. So I just came back there around the end game.
If you don't have Reflect for Asura, it's it's a real challenge. I tried it. I was like, nope, never, not gonna happen.
Yeah, Leviathan was really tough in the DS version. Can basically wipe your party with his tsunami attack. But I don't think Kane could equip swords in the older versions. Is that right?
No, he can.
He can. So you can do Defender and Avenger, like Defender on Cecil, Avenger on Kane.
Yep.
Because that is, oh my god, once I had that going, that's like the first time I felt overpowered in this playthrough. That was nice.
The Avengers are really good sword.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Avenger is I think their way of telling you, oh hey, casting Berserk on an attacker is very, very effective. Because even though it has lower attack power than the other weapons you'll find at the time, because you don't have to, it'll be faster because they don't have to waste time processing their turn, their like move menu. And you get the 50% bonus from Berserk attacking anyway. So it's the Avenger can carry you all the way to the end game on Cecil or Kane. But I usually just like shields too much, so I'll have them use it for a while, but not for like the fight against Zeromus.
Oh, you can't equip a shield with it?
No, it's a two-handed sword.
Yeah.
Oh, you can equip a shield with it in the DS version. Oh. So Kane just felt like busted at this point of the game. It was pretty great.
Yeah, if you only want him attacking and not jumping, that does seem ideal. But at least when I was using it this time, you couldn't equip shields. I thought that was the case in the Super Nintendo version as well, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Well, but anyway, this part of the game does have a lot of optional content in front of you. I think the Avenger is found. It's found in one of those dungeons, right?
It's in the Sylph Cave. Yeah.
And it was either the Sylph Cave or the Path to the Summoned Monsters. But so there's a lot of optional stuff ahead of you exploring the underworld. There's a secret smithy in the extreme southeast corner of the map that where you can exchange tales for you can exchange ore for endgame equipment, and you get ore by giving rare tales to the tail collector on the overworld. So you can't do anything with that right now, but if you find the rat tail in the Fey March and then in the overworld, give it to the you can exchange it for for adamantite, and then go back down underground. You get the Excalibur sword, Cecil's second best weapon, doing that. So again, like the kitchen knife and Yang and the rat tail and the Excalibur, you can sort of begin all of those side quests at this part of the game, but they don't pay off until a little bit later. When you want to continue the story along, you go to one of my least favorite dungeons, the Sealed Cave.
It's the worst.
It's the cave tile set. It's a little confusing. There's a lot of elevation change, and you have to do a lot of set boss fights against these demon doors that are just irritating. I specifically remember hating this dungeon 25 plus years ago, and I didn't love it this time, but I'm glad I was able to at least turn random encounters off.
Yeah, I thought it was just fine this time. The only enemies I was fighting were the doors. And I was like, all right, I'll take this. But yeah, in the original version, it's like a moment that I dreaded and like I prepared for and I thought about. And it was like my build was about that cave. And now I'm like, whatever.
I'm pretty sure that's where I stopped playing the first time I played this game, because it's rough. And now it's not as hard, it's just annoying.
So I definitely remember also dreading the Sealed Cave in previous versions, but after doing like both the optional dungeons and getting a Defender on Cecil who could just like tank pretty much every hit, and getting the Avenger on Kane who was just relentlessly attacking, like it was actually ended up being one of the easier dungeons in the game for me, like compared to some of the earlier ones. It was I was really surprised how much I breezed through it.
Yeah, so maybe it's easier now because we've been playing this game for over 30 years. But the Sealed Cave is a bit of an annoying spot. You do end up reclaiming the crystal at the end, but not before you have to fight the demon wall. This game's, the second time where the walls closing in on you are a major mechanic or story moment. It's not, you know, that crazy, but it's a little odd that it's happened twice in this game. And I remember really struggling against the demon wall years and years ago, but now I had the Avenger equipped and I had a better idea of what to do.
The demon wall cheats. That's probably why you struggled with it.
Sounds about right.
It actually because of how the agility systems work, it works the same way Berserk does, where you like when it moves forward, it is just instantly taking its turn, regardless of what the turn order is, kind of how Berserk works in the original one. So it literally cheats the system.
Right. So speaking of unfair and cheating, at the as you leave the sealed cave, the sky darkens, and Golbez sort of gets his tendrils into Kane's mind again, and Kane betrays you again, taking the crystal back to Golbez, which will put the final stages of Golbez's plan into motion. The plan is to activate the Giant of Babel, a sort of a giant robot that will destroy the world. I think it was basically what Dr. Lugai had been building in the Tower of Babel for years and years. But you do have a means of countering this. If you go back to Cid, he attaches a drill to your airship. You go back to the surface world where you can do things like get the rat, give the rat tail to the collector, and continue the Yang side quest if you know to take care of that. But also, more importantly, the Elder of Mizidia does a prayer ritual to summon the Lunar Whale, which is your third airship of the game. which has really cool flight music that I very much enjoyed hearing for the first time in several years playing this game again. But basically, this giant airship, vaguely whale in shape, there's an option to touch the crystal inside of it to zoom all the way to the moon, where some of the background influencers behind this whole story reside. After traveling across the moon a little bit, there's a Naming Way cave where you can take care of some stuff, where they also sort of reveal to you that the Naming Ways that you meet throughout the game are aliens from the moon, in fact. And an optional dungeon where you can get Bahamut, the strongest summon, but I was definitely not strong enough to take on Bahamut at this point of the game. But more importantly, you'd go through a couple lunar caves, taking you to a shrine, which is the resting place of the Lunarians. The Lunarians were a people that lived on Earth many, many years ago, but then they returned back to the moon to let humanity thrive without them, and eventually the Lunarians will awake from their slumber and return to Earth, but now is not that time. But when they were living on Earth, one Lunarian, Zemus, was an evil sorcerer that had to be sealed away by the other Lunarians, and Zemus is the one who has been sort of influencing the mind of Golbez and summoning monsters and trying to destroy the world, is this evil malevolent moon being from years and years earlier. And you're told all of this by the curator of this Lunarian shrine, a sage named Fusoya. And so Fusoya replaces Kane in your party for a little while. I think he also tells you that Cecil is, in fact, half Lunarian. His father, Kluya, is Fusoya's younger brother. So I guess he's Uncle Fusoya then. Fusoya is a very powerful white and black mage. I mean, his class is Lunarian, but he's basically like a more powerful version of Tella. And when you go use the Lunar Whale to get back to the surface, you aren't allowed to go around and do side quests with Fusoya or anything fun like that. No, you go straight to the Giant of Babel. You see Yang and Cid and Palom and Porom and Edward all revived and healthy again, providing cover fire for the Giant of Babel so you can go in. And this is the third machine tower dungeon of the game. Again, I really started to get annoyed with them over the years because these are just three dungeons I don't love. And through the Giant of Babel, you fight a rematch against the four elemental fiends, except you have to fight them back to back in a row. And then at the end, you fight the core of the Giant of Babel, basically a big mechanical sphere that summons a second sphere to attack and a second sphere to heal the big sphere. Which is a bit of a puzzle boss fight if you aren't overpowered or haven't played this game seven times like I have. So I that was a big info dump at once. Back to the surface, Lunar Whale, Fusoya, Cecil's half moon man, back to Giant of Babel, two boss fights in a row. What are our thoughts on this, frankly, you know, somewhat of a dense roller coaster ride of a section of the game?
So one of my least favorite things in Final Fantasy IV is the Mycidian legend. The whole one to be born of a dragon scroll sequence that it does, I think, three times over the course of the game. And it's kind of a neat idea, but I wish it had more substance to it beyond just kind of vaguely alluding to Cecil. And I don't know. If I could mash through it, I'd probably be more okay with it. I don't know. It's always bothered me. I've never loved it. And it's the one thing in this game that always just has rubbed me the wrong way.
You know, that's a fair point. I like it, but I understand your point. Like, I think you're right. Like, it's like so many of these things, parts of this game, it's half-baked, right? Like, it feels like it's sort of this like concoction of Miyazaki tropes. And so I totally agree with your point, but like for some reason, like when that music plays and I see that scroll, I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. Oh, I see it. Oh yeah. And every time, like, I get excited. I don't know. Like, it's such an interesting experience to play this game and be completely uncritical of it. Like, if anybody ever asked me to review this game, I would be like, no, I'm not doing that. Because I would give it a 99 and it deserves like probably an 80, but I would give it a 99. So like, it's really interesting. Because I agree with your criticism, but I don't feel your criticism.
It's totally fair.
I also have a soft spot for it just because like it alludes to like the general like weird like plot twists that the game ends up going on, like just the wacky things like going to the moon and the whole like two brothers thing that we're just about to get into. And yeah, it's really ridiculous, but having it like presented in like this kind of faux poetic way with like the Final Fantasy Prelude music playing, like it just like it really puts the fantasy in Final Fantasy. It really makes you feel like you're playing like a legend, and I appreciate that aspect of it quite a bit.
I will say, maybe the Japanese version of it, the dialogue for it is more impactful or makes more sense. I just wish it had a little bit more. Like, I appreciate what it wants to do, which I think tends to be one of my biggest things when I go back to these, is, you know, they had so many good ideas that I wish they'd just taken a little bit further or made a little bit more connected.
Yeah, I also wonder if they might have retranslated it for the DS version, because I think it is a fresh localization. So maybe I got a slightly nicer poetic version of it, too.
I don't mind the text crawl or the legend, because it sort of, at the beginning of the game, it hints that this story is sort of bigger than just the events taking place, and the revelation of the moon people and Cecil's connection to them sort of is tying the prophecy or legend part of the game to the actual plot of the game. But I'm mostly just annoyed that you can't like take Fusoya into the underworld and use him to fight Leviathan and Asura and all that. Like, super annoyed that Fusoya is only with you for one and a half dungeons, basically.
I would take him to fight Bahamut.
That's true. You can, because it's only when you leave the moon when you're sort of on rails until the end of the Babel dungeon. But you can use him to fight Bahamut. That is true. And having a second,
then you have a second person to cast reflect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's what I did. It was pretty great. But yeah, just giving the player a bit more agency in whether they want to take Fusoya to do like those underworld side quests would be a cool thing that they probably just could have let you do.
But anyway, at the end of this roller coaster, you get maybe the what I would call the silliest twist of the game. Fusoya basically excises Zemus's influence from Golbez, and he reveals that he's Cecil's older brother, and his father is also Kluya, the moon dragon, as it were. Which seems silly. Like, did Cecil know he had a brother? Like, why did this happen at all? I think they tried to explain some of it in the after years, but we're not going to talk about that here. I always thought it was a little, like, far more out of left field than, say, Darth Vader being Luke Skywalker's father. It's a sort of out of nowhere twist that was confusing at the time and even seems silly at this point. But Fusoya and Golbez return to the moon to stop Zemus from awakening. Kane rejoins your party because he's once again unbetrayed you and is, and you have your final party of Cecil, Kane, Rosa, Rydia, and Edge again. Now if you go back to Fusoya's resting place, you can use a new passageway there to the lunar subterrane and then the path to the core, which are sort of the two halves of the final dungeon. And you can also clean up any side quests that you want to from here, because you have three airships that each have a different purpose. This is when I got Excalibur and Bahamut and Asura and Leviathan. And I think also the kitchen knife. I don't remember.
And Odin,
true. That's right. Yeah. Odin at the basement of Baron Castle, the door that was sealed for most of the game. I'm not sure. Can you get Odin before going to the moon, or maybe you need the lunar oil for it?
Yeah, I believe you can, but like I couldn't because I needed a fifth party member. I needed Kane to make it happen for me.
That one is definitely the DPS race of the game.
A DPS check.
If you kept the Thunderclaw, you can equip that on Edge, and then it's pretty easy. Odin is super weak to lightning.
Yeah, I was able to kill him fast enough before I had a full party wipe. I did have to like attempt it a couple times though.
I think I just attacked and used Thundaga, but I think I did fight this pretty late. I don't remember it perfectly though, because I did play this game almost a full month ago. I was planning on spreading out this playthrough over a couple weeks so I'd be fresh for the podcast, but I ended up beating it in less than a week. So you can clean up all your side quests and do the Path of the Core. The Path of the Core is a fairly challenging final dungeon, at least in my memory, because I skipped a lot of the random medals this time. There is a bunch of endgame equipment hidden everywhere. The enemies drop sometimes even better equipment, but the drop rate can be pretty low. Famously, there's one or two rooms in the Path of the Core where enemies drop pink tails. But the Flan Princesses have a 1 in 64 appearance rate, and they drop a pink tail at a 1 in 64 rate. So they're very challenging to farm for. But if you give a pink tail to the tail collector and then give that adamantite to the smithy, you can get the adamant armor, the best armor in the game for everyone.
I thought about doing that again this time, and I couldn't bring myself to do it.
I've never done it. I have fought a Flan Princess a couple times when I was just like trying to see if they actually existed, because this is several years ago. So I've encountered Flan Princesses before, but I've never gotten a pink tail, and I've never seriously grinded for them. I did get lucky this time around though, because when I was leveling up to fight Zeromus at the end, and we should mention Zemus is so consumed by evil after he becomes a being of pure hate named Zeromus, who's the final boss of the game. When I was grinding for Zeromus, I was fighting, I think, red dragons and blue dragons, and a red dragon dropped a crystal ring, which wasn't a piece of equipment I'd even heard of before, because it's something like red dragons aren't that uncommon, but it's something like a 1 out of 128 drop from a red dragon, and it's basically as a arm equipment that's as good as a protect ring. So yeah, it was awesome. I was slightly mind blown that I got some rare end game equipment for the first time in this game. Some dropped rare equipment, that is. But you can there's some bosses that protect some of the final weapons, but you get the Holy Spear for Kane, the Ragnarok Sword for Cecil, the Masamune and Muramasa for Edge. Protect rings for either Edge or Rosa or Rydia is a good armor for them. You get a bunch of in-game equipment just to prepare you for Zeromus. But I did a little bit of grinding here because the final boss is hard, y'all. That is definitely a stamina check at one point.
I was going to say it was the only boss that I really struggled with, and Yeah, I mean, like, it's, you just can't, I'm not even sure that I think it's well designed. It's basically like, it will cast Big Bang multiple times. If your party can't withstand that attack, you're just going to die. And there's really not much you can do about it, except for level grind.
Sometimes he will counterattack with Flare, which is often an instant death. And sometimes he will cast Black Hole to clear out all of your boosts that you've cast on yourself. But it's but he only does those things, and he is fast as hell. And some, and when I first attempted him, like he was getting like two big bangs for every one of my turns, and I just couldn't survive. But so I had to do some extra grinding.
It never really been an issue in previous games for me, I guess, and that's gets back to like the I turn off encounters, but like the path to the core is like pretty challenging. So like to get through that, you have to be at pretty high level. So like I think that's just that's a me problem. So yeah,
I'm still not 100% sure, but I do think this is one of those where they changed how the mechanics work, and because a lot of the stuff that I noticed on this playthrough that changed was stuff that felt like it was off because of the agility, because the way the agility works, because this uses something closer to FF6's active time battle system instead of the way FF4 originally did it. And I'm wondering if they just left Zeromus' stats alone, but changed how those stats affect the game. Because he's not supposed to be, well, I guess I won't say he wasn't supposed to be that fast, but he was not that fast in the original game. You should be able to attack and heal between big bangs, and you could in the SNES version.
Yeah, I don't remember getting consecutive big bangs in the DS version, and in general, like, this was the easiest time I have ever had with just the final dungeon and the Zeromus like all together. And I think part of that is because I was just steadily leveling through the game because I had to just be able to get past some of the boss checks. But part of it is also just that with the augments I had at the end of the game, like I was just cooking up some insanity. And if y'all don't mind, I just want to like walk through what my party build was for a second, because like just what you could do in the DS version is kind of crazy if you've gotten like at least some of the best augments. And so like for Cecil, I had so augments, just to reiterate, like you get these abilities throughout the game. If you give some augments to like party members that end up leaving your party, like temporary party members, then they'll give you like their character specific augments after they leave your party. So what I had was like, I had attack on Cecil. I used white magic on him for a lot of the game, but towards the end of the game, I ended up giving him Yang's focus so he can charge up very powerful physical attacks. He had counter, which basically meant that every time he got physically attacked, he could just, he automatically like countered with his own sword attack. He also had this draw attacks one, which is basically that every single target move that an enemy throws out automatically gets directed at Cecil. So he was tanking like every single target physical hit or magic attack. And then I also had Brace, which is also from Yang, which basically is a better defend. So he was just able to like tank like almost everything. It was amazing. Rosa then had like white magic together with Omni casting, which I got like just before the final dungeon from Fusia, which basically means you can use single target magic attacks on multiple targets. So that's party wide shell, party wide protect, haste, and arise or life too. So if like everybody's dead except Rosa, you arise and they're all back full health. And that's also with Fast Talker from Tella, which just decreased the charge time on all of her magic. So she was just like, that was like the best white magic I've ever had going on. And also Prey in this version heals HP and MP based on like a percentage. So that was just really good for getting through the final dungeon without having to rely on ethers. Kane then was just like a physical attacking machine. He had attack, he had jump. He had darkness, which works a bit differently in this version. It's not like a multi-target that does damage. It's actually like an install that makes all of his physical attacks do double damage at the cost of a percentage of his HP. But because you have jump, you put on darkness and then you jump, like you're not taking too much damage in return for like basically a guaranteed 9,999 hit. And then he also had Phoenix from Fusaya, which is basically that if he dies, then everybody else in the party who's dead comes back to life. And because his health is usually staggered because he's in the air all the time, it'll often be that like my whole party got wiped. Then Kane comes back from the air. He dies, and then everybody else comes back to life, which is just crazy.
Man,
and
you're making me want to play this version now. Oh
yeah, I really that's the whole point of the spiel, because you could do some. I didn't even get all of the best augments.
That sounds fun, but I remember the DS version well enough to not want to replay it again.
Just use an augment guide, and like you'll have a much much better time. That's like I wouldn't recommend this to anybody going in blind. Like, look up where the augments are so you can actually get them and have some fun with the system. And then Rydia gets the Stardust Rod, which allows her to cast Comet for free, right? Yep. And then earlier in the game, I put the item lore augment on her, which doubles the effects of every item. And I only did this because just to be like economic with using my ethers, just so like a regular ether would do 100 MP recovery instead of just 50, and a dry ether would do 200 MP recovery instead of 100. But it ended up also doubling the effect of her Stardust Rod when used as an item. So I was basically getting MP free Comet, which basically was doing 9,999 to the whole party of enemies I was fighting. And then Edge was a little more basic than the other characters. I was mostly using him as a support for like ninjutsu that gave him smoke to like escape from battles, and then Mirage to boost his evasion. And then he also had this reach augment, which allowed him to do full physical damage from the back row, which just made him a safer character to use. So, I mean, that's just my little spiel. If anybody's considering the DS version, let that be a potential incentive to maybe get into it one day, because I had so much fun playing with these augments.
But only with a guide, because it's none of that is explained, and a lot of it is hidden. I found the DS version very frustrating, so I'm not going to go back to it. But yes, that level of build variety does sound interesting. I mean, if anything, this makes me want to go back to the PSP version, because I kind of want to run the final battles, or at least endgame content, with like Super Edward and Yang again.
Yeah, that's fun too.
And some of the equipment in that version, like the Mist Ring, makes your Mist Rydia's Mist Dragon Summon also cast Image on the entire party and deal about as much damage as Bahamut. So stuff like that I always found pretty entertaining. It also gives Rydia new endgame equipment that isn't the damn Minerva dress, which is like minus 15 to her intellect and spirit. Don't give Rydia the Minerva dress unless you want to make her a whip attacker.
Don't give anyone the Minerva dress, because Zeromus only uses magic attacks and he will just murder you if you have negative spirit.
Yeah, it's a really disappointing ultimate equipment, that Minerva dress.
Yeah, but the GBA and PSP versions, they give you they have Yang, Edward, Palom, Porom, and Cid all rejoin your team at the end of the Giant of Babel stuff. They give you a new dungeon in the Mount Ordeals for end game equipment for those five, and then after you've beaten Zeromus once, they give you a new lunar dungeon that gives you post game equipment for every character, including the five originals and five returnings. So it's I really had a lot of fun grinding for all of those. Again, probably 10 years ago, I remember I played the FF4 on the Vita, but I don't know exactly when that was. But yeah, FF4 has a lot of versions. We've mentioned it a couple times, but I think maybe my favorite parts of the Pixel Remaster version are the ability to turn encounters off and on. This time around, I didn't know that you could increase your experience points also in a menu here. I was just pressing the right stick to turn encounters off and on, so I didn't have experience juiced up. But when I replayed Final Fantasy V right after this game, I did know that, so I was able to grind better for that one. But also, the remixed music in this game is so good. I want every version to have the Pixel Remaster remixes of the music, because mm-hmm. like they were across the board excellent, and sort of in like an enhanced version of my old nostalgia, like that comparison that we make all the time for things like HD 2D. It's as beautiful as you remember it being, instead of how as beautiful as it actually was. But yeah, I mean, if we were talking about the final, about version differences in the final battle, there's nothing really to talk about except for the very end. You get some endgame cutscenes. Before the final battle, you do the famous thing that I always call an FF4 situation, where your party is down, but one by one, people that you've met throughout the game, they join you in spirit and heal you back to full, so you can get back to fighting the final boss. Oh boy, a zillion games do this. Earthbound does a version of this. Persona 4 does a version of this. But whenever there's like an endgame battle where all your friends you made along the way show up in some form or another, I consider that an FF4 moment. But after the FF4 moment and you defeat Zeromus, before that even, you see Golbez and Fusoya fall to Zeromus, but because there's still darkness in Golbez's heart, he isn't able to land the final blow, but he gives the crystal he was using to Cecil, and Cecil's able to, you know, unleash the true form of Zeromus, and then you get that difficult final battle that we've been talking about a little while. But then at the end game, Golbez decides to, because he's so ashamed of everything he's done, he decides to go to sleep with Fusoya and the rest of the Lunarians and maybe rejoin civilization in the far future. But before he leaves, Cecil decides to, you know, show a remarkable amount of grace for everything that Golbez has done and call him brother. But only after being goaded by the rest of your party. But then you return to the surface. There's just a bunch of happy proceedings. It's revealed that Edge was crushing on Rydia, which is not something I picked up in the original game until the very, very end game.
They really play that up in the DS version. Like, he does that a lot more throughout the game, of just like trying to hit on her.
In later versions of the game with more dialogue, it is much clearer.
Yeah, it seemed like he was kind of being a womanizer. But it mostly seemed like he was hitting on Rosa. And, like, throughout the game, he was, he called Rydia, like, a little kid a couple times. And that made crush reveal kind of awkward.
Yeah, it seemed confusing and unexpected when I first saw the ending a long, long time ago. But in the later versions of the game, including the DS version, that have more dialogue, I think it is sort of clear that Rydia is just very sassy, and Edge thinks she's beautiful, but doesn't react to her well. And then it's clear that he has a crush on her, even though he's a bit of a playboy back in his Prince of Eblonde days. But it's abundantly clear in the ending, Edge likes Rydia. Yeah. A bunch of people visit the castle, visit Baron Castle, so that I think Cecil's being crowned king, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Right. And but Cain does not attempt the Cain does not attend the ceremony because he feels like he has soul searching to do, and it shows him with his helmet on and flowing blonde locks on Mount Ordeals. But you get the big Final Fantasy fanfare and a credits roll with a mostly optimistic ending. And yeah, that's Final Fantasy IV, one of the true classics of the genre. I mean, any final thoughts before we move on to housekeeping?
Cain is the best edgelord in any RPG.
That's a true story.
Definitely a prototype edgelord and an excellent one at that.
Yep. I think that's a good summation of it. Cain is the prototype edgelord, but you could say that about just about everything in this game. It is the prototype of all of the modern JRPGs in a lot of ways, where it really is kind of the first game that did a lot of this, like, from the melodrama and the betrayals and the...
Yeah.
I mean, again, just having the characters that it does and the story that it does.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was part of like a movement towards storytelling with like Phantasy Star 2 and Dragon Quest 4, but it definitely, I think, hits it in a way that those games do not. And it also brings approachable mechanics in a way that especially something like Phantasy Star 2 does not. And so yes. I think that
they still have opaque as hell mechanics by the time they got to Phantasy Star 4.
That's a like, true story.
No one can explain to me what all the spells do in that game. It's impossible.
I agree. But yeah, I think that it should be celebrated for that, and just celebrated for just being so earnest in what it wants to be and whether it's always successful. I'm not the right person to answer that question because I think it's always successful.
Yeah, like it's funny listening to you like list off like the individual plot points during these two episodes, Celosi, and just like listening to them being like, that sounds stupid. But it really doesn't feel that stupid when you're playing the game, because like even though like the general plot points of the game are ridiculous and could sometimes feel abrupt and underdeveloped, like the game like knows what it's doing in terms of like keeping its momentum going, in terms of like using its aesthetics to have impact with things like Cecil changing from like a Dark Knight into a Paladin, having that so clearly reflected in his like character sprite. Same thing with like Rydia being like a little kid when you first meet her, and then coming back and she's got a whole new character sprite. She's bigger, she's all grown up, and then just like moving from like the overworld and thinking that's everything to like the underground to the moon. Like there's such a, like even though the game is only like really like 20 hours unless you're playing the DS version, like there's such a epic feel and sense of scope that the game manages because of it's constantly giving you new party members which have new mechanics. It's constantly like showing character development in these very RPG specific ways, and in that sense, like it's still great to play. It's doing a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, it takes wild swings, and it's tonally sometimes confusing. Like, you feel like this is a medieval fantasies kind of game, but then there's these three machine tower dungeons, and you travel to the moon in a giant whale spaceship. And it really does sort of... I mean, the game has a confusing relationship with technology, is all I'm saying. But but for some reason, it all fits neatly together. And even revisiting parts of the world when you have more freedom of travel is mostly rewarding. I don't think the storytelling is as sophisticated as later games would be. Like basically, Squaresoft got better at this throughout the 90s because there's like very little foreshadowing and very little world building as you're continuing as you play through FF4. But other games did it much better. But because it's the prototype for so many of these things, and it's super entertaining in its own right, because it feels like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, I mean, this is a super important RPG, both for the mechanics of JRPGs of the era and the storytelling of JRPGs of the era. And this was, I mean, maybe this is a generalization, but I think this is the game that kicked off Square's really, really excellent run for the entire decade of the 1990s, that was the definitive oeuvre of JRPGs for a lot of people my age that grew up loving JRPGs. Like maybe that's an overgeneralization, but this feels like really the first game of that outstanding run that I think of as one of the all-time great runs of a single developer making video games.
Absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, you know, we've done episodes on Final Fantasy 4, 5, 6, and Tactics, and 10. There's some missing ones in there.
8. No, just me.
Just you.
Just you.
8. of all the Final Fantasy games from 91 to 2001, 8 is my least favorite. But I know it's much loved by a lot of people. Maybe I should revisit it. But that's not going to be in the next few months, at least, because we already have the next couple of months planned out at Retro Encounter. But before I get into all of that, thank you so much, Zach, Lucas, and Alex, for revisiting this childhood favorite of mine. Again, my first JRPG that I played in large part at a sleepover, I think in 1994. But yeah, this was a lot of fun revisiting it, and I'm glad that I got the Pixel Remasters, because I've already beaten Final Fantasy V in the intervening few weeks, and I'm going to play FF6 for sure later this year. Maybe after that, maybe it's time for me to think about giving FF8 a chance.
I'll be here when you decide to, Celosi.
It's but, not. Well, remarkably though, the game in between FF6 and 8, Final Fantasy VII, is a game I'm playing right now, sort of. because I am still going through Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, the second game of the FF7 remake trilogy, which came out right at the end of February, I think a couple days before my birthday. Pretty soon in Retro Encounter, we're doing a spoiler cast on FF7 Rebirth. That's going to be the second or third week of April, I think. So I really need to get off my ass and finish that thing. I'm pretty sure chapter 4, which is not nearly far along enough. I might have to do some hardcore grinding in that game over the next couple of weeks. Yeah, I know. But I spent way too long in chapter 2 doing every side quest. I might have to mainline it a little bit later. We'll see how that goes. But Zach, I know you reviewed FF7 Rebirth for the website and you enjoyed it a lot. Yep. And I'm not at the end game yet, but I'm sure when I am, I'm going to be very eager to talk about it with you and a few others.
I will be as well.
But that's not the only thing we have already set for April. Next week, we're doing two episodes on Koei Tecmo's Musou series, or Warriors series, which is Dynasty Warriors, Samurai Warriors, and then like dozens of other licensed games over the past 25 years or so. For some reason, those games have gotten sort of more popular and more varied and more like RPGs over the years. And there's a surprisingly large number of games and styles to talk about. I've played two Warriors/Musou games over the last 2 weeks, and I have some thoughts about them, but we have a couple of Musou super fans on that episode to talk about those games next week. Also, we're doing a mini celebration of the Fallout series in April, because Fallout's Amazon Prime television series is coming out very soon, and there's going to be a mini feature on RPGFan.com with retro reviews of at least three different Fallout games. I think there's several planned, but I don't know. You'd have to ask Jono for all of the details there. So Jono is going to host a Fallout episode for Retro Encounter also in April. But we also have some regularly scheduled game journals in April. After the FF7 spoiler cast and the Fallout episode, we're going to have an episode on Ark the Lad, the PS1 classic strategy RPG, and also Ark the Lad 2, its much longer, much more elaborate sequel. So I think we were originally going to have just Ark the Lad 1 on for the podcast, but the host of those episodes told me that they think it would be a better idea to just have one about Ark the Lad 1 and a second about Ark the Lad 2. So we're going to have Ark the Lad 1 and 2 get dedicated episodes in April and possibly going into early May. And we do have most of May planned out, but I don't want to reveal all of it yet. But I will say that we have a special guest from the content creation world coming in one of those May episodes. And if you follow RPG and JRPG content creators on YouTube, maybe you've heard of that person. So please look forward over the next few months to some episodes about Fallout, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, Koei Tecmo games, Ark the Lad games, and a few special plans for May. But if you want to reach out to us about Final Fantasy IV or Fallout or Final Fantasy VII Rebirth or Dragon Quest Heroes, The World Tree's Woe, and The Blight Below, you can always email us retro@rpgfan.com. Follow RPG Fan on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, Discord, the proper website rpgfan.com, of course. And on all of those places, we provide content every day. Also on rpgfan.com, there's a shop on rpgfan.com/shop where you can find our Tee Public store linking to RPG Fan merchandise and apparel, or our link to Hyperplay RPG, a UK-based publisher that released a 300-page tome of RPG Fan reviews, edited to single pages. It's a really, really cool book, so please buy the RPG Fan book and whatever merch you like on our shops. And also, Retro Encounter, of course, is not the only podcast here. The RPG Fan Podcast Network also includes Random Encounter every 2 weeks about randomness and what games are playing, as well as Rhythm Encounter every other 2 weeks about RPG music. You can review Retro, Random, or Rhythm Encounter on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify, or however you listen to podcasts. Please give us all the feedback you're willing to provide. But if you want to give us feedback as individuals, and follow us on social media, and not just as a podcast or a website, let's tell the listeners how to find us, starting with you, Lucas.
You can find me everywhere at RaefGall, RaefGall. I'm on pretty much all the social medias, and especially on YouTube, where I release daily Let's Plays, including this entire playthrough of Final Fantasy IV.
Excellent. Now, Zach, how can listeners find you?
You can email me, ZachW@RPGFan.com, or you can find me on our Discord as ZachW.
Now, Alex.
You can email me at AlexFrenichek@gmail.com.
And listeners, you can find me on most social medias. I am at Evoker for Dogs on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Discord, but not the bird site. You can also email me if you want, Solosi@rpgfan.com, but I also check the retro@rpgfan.com email address every day. But yeah, you know what? I sort of miss the days where we didn't have our own theme music for Retro Encounter, because I would love nothing more than to have this episode play out on, you guessed it, the Fat Chocobo Tuba song.
Do it.
Oh man,
what a classic. Best song in the game, right?
I mean, obviously. Listeners, thank you.
I need to look up the now I need to look up the orchestrated version of that.
Oh, once I got to the Dwarf Castle basement, you know I checked that right away. But listeners, thank you. Good night and good luck.